Well, the Anzac Day almost upon us. We thought the time might be right for a chat about the state of the world and the state of our world in particular. Last Sunday, we were talking with Waikato University's Professor of International Law, Dr. Al Gillespie, as the Iranian missiles were in the air on their way to Israel. Though, as we know, not many arrived. Morena Al.
Good morning, Jim.
The strange-seeming retaliation by Israel against Iran in response to the missile attack on Israeli territory, which in turn was a response on the attack to the attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus, which killed a couple of top Iranian military leaders. Is this all, which would offer us reassurance, is this all a calibrated tit-for-tat which avoids wider conflict? I see Iran's even denied that the attack on the Isfahan area came from Israel. They've dismissed it as insurgency. Your analysis of this, please.
Well, I think Iran has to deny the attack to begin with, because otherwise it shows that Israel has a much greater military capacity than many people feared. With regards to the normality of it, I think we're in a situation where neither Iran nor Israel feel that the international rules protect them. And we're now operating in a very dangerous area where countries are using threats and counter threats as a way to try to balance their relationship. It's an incredibly fragile point to be sitting on right now.
Yes. But is it a case also of both leaders having a lot to lose if things escalate? Because both attacks were telegraphed. And are we seeing caution as well?
Some attacks are telegraphed. I'm not sure that those who were killed in the consulate in Syria got advance notice.
No.
In a rational world, both sides have a lot to lose by the conflict escalating. The problem is we're not in a rational space right now. Unfortunately, both leaders also have a lot to gain from focusing on their external enemies, because it would be a large distraction from their own domestic considerations for both Iran and for Israel.
Yeah.
My fear from here is that Israel has spent the last 10 years saying it will not tolerate a nuclear-armed Iran. And where the situation is now, this gives them the chance to actually carry out some of those threats that have long been voiced.
Yes, and black swans are always on the wing, aren't they, as well? So in the history of war, measured reactions, which these seemingly are, can become out of control.
These are a particular type of reaction. These are known as reprisals. And this is where you have one prohibited act following another prohibited act as a way to deter the opposition. So you would have seen historically, if some of our prisoners were executed, you would execute some of the opposition prisoners. But with regards to aerial bombardment, the practice is what starts out measured ends up in a very indiscriminate, inhumane situation. Like with the Second World War, both sides promised that they would have great restraint. But as both mistakes and anger escalated, it ended up in the bombing of each other's cities.
In terms of Iran's outrage, I mean, Iran set a precedent for bombing embassies when it attacked the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires in 1992, didn't it? Because an Argentine court has just handed down a ruling which says so.
That's correct. I mean, the Iranian history of respect for diplomatic premises is very poor. And some people may remember in 1979 when they took over the American embassy and held it for 444 days. Despite that, the importance of the protection of both diplomatic staff and diplomatic premises is one of the foundations of international law. And it goes back hundreds, if not thousands of years. And we need to have this because it means that countries, even if they disagree, can still have the ability to talk to each other.
Mm.
So it's not just an attack on the embassy, it's an attack on what it represents at the same time.
Yes. Meanwhile, inside Iran, reports The Guardian, anger continues unabated that at this moment of national tension, the regime's decided to launch another crackdown on women for not wearing the hijab. There are myriad instabilities in these societies and no seeming route to stability. I mean, a two-state solution for Palestinians is likewise just wishful thinking at the moment.
We've been working on the necessity of the two-state solution since 1947. And the need for that is greater than ever because we need to have a vision of what peace may look like in the future. But only very recently at the Security Council, we found that the United States once more used its veto to object to this proposal of Palestinian statehood. And of note, it was the only country that used its veto. And so now there's a greater consensus of the international community that this is necessary as a step towards peace. But unfortunately, again, it's been pushed off the table.
Before we bring this discussion back home, Ukraine is now losing the war at the moment with Russia because of materiel shortages, although House Democrats in the US have joined Republicans to pass a bill providing more aid, which will head to the Senate now. Xi Jinping released a very vague four-point plan to address the crisis, but he did suggest he's worried about global instability and supply chains again. What are the options for Ukraine now in that war, do you think? Russia would never countenance Ukraine joining NATO, you'd suppose, and the NATO countries might not offer unconditional guarantees to repel aggression.
There's many elements to make a peace treaty, and so you'd have to push aside questions of compensation. You'd have to push aside questions of war crimes and accountability. You'd have to make sure that any annexed territory became independent and couldn't become part of Russia. But the key point is about whether they can join NATO or not. And this is the stumbling block for both Russia and the Ukraine. I expect that if the Ukraine was allowed to join NATO, even if they had a reduced state in size, they would accept the deal, because at least that way they would be guaranteed security and some sovereignty in the future.
There's been much talk this past week over New Zealand's future commitments to the defence arrangement known as AUKUS. AUKUS Pillar 2 compromises New Zealand's principled independent voice, was one headline. And Pillar 2 is about sharing advanced technology and so on. The quid pro quo here is what worries critics of this possible deal. Economically first, can I ask you, our exports to China are already considerably down at the moment, so might that be less of a worry for us than it has been?
I think it's still a very big worry and a justifiable one. I mean, there's still 27% of our exports are going to China. They seem to have plateaued and fallen a little bit in last year, but it still makes up a significant part of our GDP.
All right, then. Do we need AUKUS?
AUKUS is a separate and big question, and there's two ways you can look at this. If you're looking at it in terms of just basically military kit, then the argument is quite strong, because the next generation of military hardware and software will be completely different in the 21st century to what it was in the 20th. It's about autonomous weapons, it's about AI, it's about hypersonic missiles, it's about cyber warfare. And it's not just about offensive capacity, it's also about defensive capacity. If we are to have a viable military that goes beyond a policing function, then yes, I think we need new kit. People will point out that there's other providers of new kit, but the problem we've got now is that much of our interoperability is with Australia, it is with Britain, and it is with America. The question of values is important, because obviously you're looking at liberal democracies, of which we've got a long history and shared relationships, which are good and positive. But on the other side of the equation is, what does the implications of all this mean? Do we still have an independent voice? And critically, will this pull us into wars without our consent, as our forces get dragged into sometimes what is a whirlpool of quickly unfolding events?
Okay, but just going back to the economic situation, if we join AUKUS, this Pillar 2 stage of it, it will be in concert with other nations. So would this blunt the possible retaliatory economic effect for us? I mean, what other repercussions might there be? How will China view it?
It would make sense for any country which wants to join AUKUS Tier 2 to do it in conjunction with like-minded countries, because that would help deflect any reaction from China. And so Japan is thinking about it, South Korea is thinking about it, maybe Canada, even possibly the Philippines. The problem with that is that you will force China to react in a similar way, potentially making greater relationships with countries like Russia, and Russia with North Korea, and even possibly Iran. At the moment, the only two that are connected are North Korea and China. But the more that the Western countries link up, the more you can expect the authoritarian countries to respond in kind.
Okay, so is there any likely way that this can be avoided? Are there groupings of great powers about to square off in time-honoured fashion? What do you think?
I think we're seeing a traditional pattern that is common throughout history, whereby great alliances start to form together as a way to deter the opposition from making the first move. And sometimes these power blocks can balance each other, but at other times they can fragment. The one I'm particularly concerned about at the moment is the way that countries grouped together before the Second World War, in particular Germany, Italy, and Japan, at the same time that the international order, the League of Nations, was falling apart. I do hear echoes of that point right now.
Professor Al Gillespie is with us. Even if the world does divide itself into blocks like this, like that, does this necessarily lead to war? I mean, populations aren't as obedient, arguably, as they were before World War One or even World War Two, or as naive now?
The risk is when you get irrational actors or you get occurrences on the side that no one's expected for. And we should remember also that this part of the success in breaking the Cold War was in keeping the Soviet Union away from communist China. But right now we're moving towards a position where each week we seem to be forcing them closer together. With regards to the question about population sizes, I think it's very unlikely that there will be a World War III, but if there is one, I don't see it being based upon mass conscription. I see it being based upon advanced technology and weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah. Well, we think of AUKUS being an upgrade of ANZUS in our minds, and then we think of ANZAC and the old ties that kind of bind still. So, despite our principled independent voice since the 1980s, the defence relationship with Australia, which goes back so long, hasn't really changed either.
I see AUKUS as an addition to a long-standing relationship. The only defence agreement we have as a country is from 1944 with Australia, where we are pledged to help defend them. But on top of that, we have the Five Eyes Agreement, we have the ANZUS Agreement, and although New Zealand is frozen out of the ANZUS Agreement, the Australians aren't. Their ANZUS Agreement for Australia and America is still very alive. And so this means that if America gets into a fight that pulls in Australia, New Zealand may still get pulled into that fight if Australia is hit. AUKUS is just an additional layer on an already complicated relationship, which is not always as transparent as it should be.
Richard Prebble in the New Zealand Herald: it's lunacy to join a military alliance aimed at our biggest trading partner. Losing our trade with China would devastate our economy, which you refer to. He also says this: New Zealand should welcome China's interest in the South Pacific. They're some of the poorest countries. Their needs are far greater than New Zealand can supply or the West has been willing to provide. Chinese aid's been criticised, but the Chinese give what the island nations request rather than the aid that the West says they need. Is he right in that the Chinese are doing for Pacific nations, whatever their motives, what the US has especially has failed to do?
In some regards, Mr. Prebble is correct because we need to find areas where we can cooperate in not just the Pacific, but with globalization in general, whether you're talking about climate change or sustainable development or economic policy. We need to find areas where we're not in conflict with countries we disagree with, but where we can work. And the development of the Pacific should be a primary area. And that means if you can agree on the amounts of aid you can give and the principles by which you give it to, then that can be a win-win situation. The problem is when you get aid given over that goes against democracy or against the rule of law or against principles which are critical to our liberal democracies. But in between that, there should be areas of cooperation that should be to the benefit of the Pacific. And as much as we must bolster our own relationships in the Pacific because it's our responsibility, we must also seek areas of cooperation and not necessarily conflict with those we disagree with.
And we've always turned a blind eye when we trade with countries that have principles and even actions that we don't like that are incompatible with liberal democracy. So that makes the situation even more complex. We don't necessarily have to approve of what people we do business with are doing elsewhere.
But we have to have bottom lines of what's tolerable and what's not. And increasingly, we're finding that those bottom lines are becoming, well, much more to the front than they were in the past. So when you've got situations of extreme human rights abuse, or when you've got countries which are openly violating the international rule of law, then sometimes you've got to say, no, we can't have interaction with you. But in other times, we may not like it, but it's better in the longer term to still keep those pathways of cooperation open.
One question is something we've been aware of for decades now. The United States wants us as a very good friend, but arguably, Al, it did take its eyes off the Pacific and it never offered us a free trade deal. If you want to have firm allies, don't you treat them better in terms of trade? Wouldn't that be a sensible idea? I know there are internal voices which don't want it in America, but wouldn't that be the bottom line for loyalty?
If you look at recent practice, you would see that Australia got a free trade agreement with the United States after its recent support in the early part of the century. Japan has a much better relationship on trade, as does South Korea with the United States. And obviously, Canada has a very good relationship with America on trade as well. So I think it would be a fair expectation that if we were to get closer into the alliance with the United States, that there would be some reciprocity and that we could expect better trading terms. The problem with the trade debate is just the acronym of FTA causes so much concern with both the Republicans and the Democrats in the United States that neither Mr. Biden nor Mr. Trump would be willing to accept a free trade deal with New Zealand. But there are other ways you can expand the cooperation, maybe within existing brackets or in new technologies. But if we get closer to America to take some of the heat off the equation, it would only be fair that we got something more than our current relationship gives.
Are we going into the second pillar of AUKUS, do you think? And will that be the real test of our economic friendship with China, just before we let you leave?
I think it's a fait accompli. To me, it's a foregone conclusion that we are going to join the second tier. I have deep concerns about the decision, and I'd like much more public debate about what the implications of this are. But right now, there seems to be a momentum that's pushing us towards it. Each week, you can see increasing tensions, which are either in Europe, in the Middle East, or in the Indo-Pacific. And I feel that there's a current just pulling us closer towards our traditional friends and allies. But if that does occur, we must have the public debate so people understand what the implications of this is. It's not neutral, and it does have grave implications for our choices. But there are good arguments for it, and there are good arguments against it.
Very good. And thank you for your time, as usual, Professor Al Gillespie. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jim.